Hello, and welcome to our program, Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest here on Owl Radio. First off, three stories to make your day from Glad to Hear It, part of the World of Good in Reader's Digest. After two failed surgeries to remove a benign brain tumor of the pituitary gland, Melanie Shaha of Gilbert, Arizona, started radiation treatment. A side effect was that she lost her hair permanently. "I don't mind being sick," she told Today Parents, "but I mind looking sick." Her son, Matt Shaha, 27 years old, soon offered to grow out his hair to make a wig for her. Melanie nixed the idea, but Matt insisted. Pointing to his golden locks, he joked, "Coming soon to a head near you." After Matt's hair grew 12 inches, he had it chopped off and sent to Compassionate Creations, which creates customized wigs for patients suffering from hair loss. It was a hit. "The color is spectacular," says Melanie. "As for her son's gift, it sure fills your emotional cup." Derek Gotchi was outside a friend's home, shutting the trunk of his GMC Yukon when a stranger jumped into the driver's seat and sped off into the Minneapolis night, with Gotchi's four children in the back, all under 5 years old. Luckily, the suspect had abandoned a stolen van nearby with the engine running. Derek jumped in and took chase. "I didn't know what to do," he told KSTP News in Minneapolis. "I'm going after my kids." He caught up with the Yukon a few blocks later and slammed the back of it with the van, pushing it into an alleyway and pinning it against a fence. The suspect fled, leaving the kids unharmed. Told by police what her husband did, Dina Gotchi nodded, "Yep, that sounds like my husband." And the third of our stories, when they learned that children in their hometown of Frazeesburg, Ohio, were going hungry, Jason Watson, a phys ed teacher, and his wife Anne, a school librarian, decided to bring food to the kids in the most fun way possible, a mint-colored ice cream truck. For the past two summers, the couple have served about 70 meals a week, delivering home-cooked lunches and ice cream to those in need. "Helping people is easy," Ann told talk show host Jennifer Hudson. "Find your passion. Find what the need is in your community and hit the ground running." Next in Reader's Digest, a story of national interest. I was run over by an SUV. Here's what it felt like. Tamara Dean from The Guardian with "It Happened So Fast" in Reader's Digest. "I heard a woman say she was hit by a car. I thought, it sounds as if she's talking about me, but that can't be right. I couldn't see. I didn't know where I was. But I wasn't worried. I sensed that I was surrounded by purposeful strangers and that my partner, David, was by my side. Abruptly, I grunted and twisted. A nurse thrust a bedpan toward me. I dismissed the bedpan, leaned right, and vomited blood all over the bed rail. Still, I wasn't alarmed or in pain. Yet, I was only perplexed. The last thing I remembered was leaving a grocery store and thinking, these bags are heavy. That had been 3 hours earlier. Given the police report, doctors' notes, and conversations I've had with eyewitnesses since that time in the hospital, I've gathered some of the details from the time I lost. On a Thursday afternoon back in May 2021, I was walking across University Avenue in Minneapolis when a black SUV turned left from an intersecting street. He was going fast, an eyewitness told me later. He ran you right over. I asked people, even in the hospital, when my mind was muddled, did I have right-of-way? Yes. Was I wearing headphones? No one knew. Why did the driver hit me? No one could say. And the SUV driver couldn't be questioned because, after stopping briefly, he had fled. My left eye was purple, swollen, closed, and bulging. My skull was fractured in three places. A long, ragged gash that started at my left temple was stapled closed. I was in a neck brace because of a cracked vertebra. My right foot was sprained, and my left shoulder was broken and torn. Bruises covered my limbs and face, but most concerning were my traumatic brain injuries, which doctors initially called severe. On my first night in the ICU, my brain was still swelling. Pedestrian fatalities on American streets have surged in the past decade. In the year 2021, 7,485 pedestrians were killed by vehicles. That's an increase of more than 65% since the year 2011. Even during COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns, when fewer people were driving, more pedestrians were hit, and more died as a result. Researchers speculate that drivers took advantage of empty streets and flouted traffic rules. Another factor is the increasing popularity of SUVs, pickups, and vans, collectively known as light truck vehicles, or LTVs. These kinds of vehicles are up to 3 times more dangerous than passenger cars in collisions with pedestrians. Part of the increased danger comes from their taller front ends, which strike above the navel, a human body's center of gravity, increasing the odds of pitching pedestrians forward and driving over them. Another factor is the positioning and thickness of the pillars that frame the windshield, which reduce visibility and impair the driver's view of pedestrians, especially when turning. Finally, these vehicles are more lethal because of their overwhelming mass. As the sales and popularity of LTVs grow, so do the pedestrian fatalities they cause. But in any accident, however distracted or inexpert the driver, and whatever size the vehicle, speed is the critical factor. On average, 10% of pedestrians hit by vehicles traveling 23 miles per hour will die. But 90% of those hit at 58 miles per hour will. Coincidentally, in the spring when I was hit, researchers from the University of Minnesota's Human First, that stands for Human Factors Interdisciplinary Research in Safety and Transportation, Laboratory, that's the Human First Laboratory, which focuses on driver behavior, initiated a pedestrian safety study. Twice a week at 16 intersections in Minneapolis and 16 in its twin city, St. Paul, subjects stepped into crosswalks while researchers standing nearby marked whether a car stopped for them. As the study progressed, the city posted signs on main thoroughfares that identified the percentage of drivers who had stopped for pedestrians that week. Nicole Morris, director of the Human First Lab, told me that publicizing the study's results in real time was an attempt to influence drivers to be safer. Traffic behavior is hyperlocal. It varies from city to city, even from neighborhood to neighborhood, and contagious. Knowing that most of your fellow motorists are stopping at pedestrian crossings makes you more likely to do the same. Early on, only 18% of Minneapolis drivers stopped for Morris's researchers to cross. She didn't post that statistic. It wouldn't have had a positive impact on people's driving. Because all we're saying is the vast majority of your neighbors are not stopping for pedestrians. If you don't, you're like everybody else. In St. Paul, however, 44% of drivers stopped for pedestrians when the study began. The difference between the cities' rates could be explained by inadequate pedestrian crossing markings in Minneapolis, where many crosswalks lack painted lines or signs. Greater awareness among St. Paul drivers that stopping at crossings is mandatory, and better police enforcement of pedestrian crossing laws in St. Paul. Not one of the Human First investigators was hit while testing drivers, although some had close calls, and it wasn't unusual for motorists to shout profanities. Like the Internet, says Morris, the road affords a lot of anonymity and allows people to do things that they would never do in a one-on-one interaction. It's scary because people are terrible on the Internet when they have that anonymity. Yet we have somebody in a 2-ton vehicle with the power to harm others. There's something like toxic individualism that makes drivers think, this road is mine and it's for me and you need to stay the hell out of my way. I remember only odd moments from my first 2 days in the hospital, trying to pry off the neck brace, hearing a woman say, I'm going to wash the blood out of her hair, and having the tube that was suctioning blood from my stomach pulled out through my nose. I don't remember feeling pain then. Certainly, I wasn't aware that I might have become a pedestrian fatality. But hospital staff must have recognized that possibility. The CT scans of my brain revealed, among other injuries, an acute subdural hematoma. Between 50% and 90% of these hematomas are fatal, and only 20% to 30% of patients who survive them recover full or partial brain function. In my mind, though, I was fine. When the nurse called David on the second morning after I was hit and held the phone to my head, I told him I was ready to come home. I insisted that we would take our planned trip to visit family in Michigan the following week. This episode later helped me realize how readily the brain fools itself. Brain injuries are known for changing personalities, usually in the direction of rage, anxiety, and volatility. Mine had the opposite effect. After 5 nights in the hospital, I came home dreamy, peaceful, and accepting. Why, I wondered, had I ever worried about anything? This wasn't painkiller-induced bliss. Along with blurred vision and vertigo, the feeling lasted for months. In this state of mind, I felt no bitterness toward the driver who hit me. I was curious about him. Eyewitnesses said he was short and very agitated. He drove off when I was still on the pavement, blood pooling under my head. Police never found him because the license plate number wasn't registered to the vehicle he was driving. Secretly, I began referring to the driver as, quote-unquote, my guy. I might never know him, but we would always be connected by the moment his vehicle and my body collided. I wondered how it was affecting him. When I called eyewitnesses to thank them, they told me how they were affected. One said that after hearing my voicemail message, she ran into the lobby of the bank where she worked and shouted, "That girl who got hit is alive!" Another repeated breathlessly that his heart had soared when he listened to my message. He was the one who had called 911 and advised the men kneeling beside me that if I was still breathing and had a pulse, I was and I did, they shouldn't perform CPR. He told me that the bystander effect, in which people pass an accident and refuse to get involved, hadn't proved true in my case. 2 dozen people had stopped to help. As a group, they assumed I wouldn't survive. Some told me they had searched the news for my name under quote-unquote pedestrian fatalities. Maybe the driver had done the same. I imagined the accident would weigh on him. Studies show that the more fault drivers believe they bear for hitting a pedestrian, the more likely they are to leave the scene. Younger male drivers are more apt to flee. So are those who are intoxicated or lack a valid license. Other factors include the age of the victim. Children and elderly people are less likely to be abandoned. Time of day, more drivers flee in darkness, and the number of people who witness the accident. Drivers might stay if several others saw it happen. In the U.S., drivers flee fatal crashes with pedestrians about 20% of the time, a rate at least 3 times higher than in other countries where such statistics are kept. What month is it? Where are you? Who's the president? In the hospital, I was quizzed several times a day. Sometimes I got things wrong. I said it was April. I said I was at a different hospital. I was asked to draw clocks, solve mazes, count by sevens, list animals, fruits, or all the words I can think of that begin with the letter P. On the fourth day, the neurosurgeon called my progress good. In a few months, he told David, this will be nothing but a bad memory. Weeks after my release, nurses who had treated me in the ICU were amazed by how healthy I looked. One squealed, "I didn't recognize you. I'm the one who washed the blood out of your hair." Even so, I had what the doctors called, quote-unquote, deficits. Nerve and inner ear damage had disrupted my sense of balance. I had to perform nauseating physical therapy exercises, such as standing one-legged on pillows and shaking my head while focusing on a straw I held in front of me. I was exhausted. I forgot things. I couldn't concentrate, couldn't absorb complex ideas. My eyes wouldn't focus. Combined, my physical and cognitive impairments meant I couldn't drive. Truthfully, I had no interest in driving. I also became a nervous passenger. When David and I drove to Michigan in the summer after I was hit, I clutched the passenger door handle, winced, and yelped through Chicago traffic. Eventually, long after doctors gave me the okay, I did return to driving, though as a changed driver. Before the crash, I had too often broken speed limits. After the crash, I was attentive and anxious behind the wheel. Part of my anxiety was because of my worsened vision and persistent shoulder pain. I became a less confident driver. I was more afraid of hitting someone than being hit again. Morris, too, finds driving stressful. Witnessing life-threatening behavior every day, she says, quote-unquote, wears on my soul. The human first researchers who stepped into crosswalks had tactics for getting drivers to give way. Stay aware of your surroundings. Cross only at designated crossings. Step into the crosswalk assertively to make your intentions clear. Wear bright colored clothing when walking at night. Make eye contact with drivers. Morris adds that she put her arm out straight, like a crossing guard, rather than waving at cars to get them to stop. "I'm very aggressive in letting people know that I'm trying to cross and that I want them to stop," Morris says, "and I get really high compliance." I resumed walking to libraries, cafes, and grocery stores. I crossed busy streets using all the recommended tactics. I didn't listen to music or podcasts. I tried to lock eyes with everyone behind a steering wheel. I stepped boldly onto crosswalks. I held my arm out like a crossing guard to alert drivers to stop if I thought they might not. Then one afternoon, David and I were walking home after buying coffees to go. Standing in a raised median between four lanes of traffic, we scanned for cars, then stepped confidently into the street. Suddenly, a silver SUV was upon us, speeding through the end of a left turn. It blazed past, its driver's side door missing the cup in my hand by inches. I screamed, but the driver, a young woman who appeared to be singing, didn't see or hear me. David and I clutched each other and hurried to the opposite curb. I was shaking, hyperventilating. This time, I was infuriated, but the silver SUV was gone before I thought to record its license plate number. The driver would never know that she had almost run over two people. That evening, lying under a blanket on the couch, I felt weighted with defeat. I thought, there's nothing pedestrians can do to ensure their safety on streets. Walkers are at the mercy of motorists. The only way to keep pedestrians safe is to drive more safely and design safer streets. I asked Morris how she would design a street for optimal safety. On a notepad, she sketched an intersection. She drew bump outs or bulges that extend curbs where pedestrians cross to make people more visible to motorists, and medians between directions of traffic to create pedestrian refuges. She drew crosswalk markings and quote-unquote stop for pedestrians signs. She described how road quote-unquote diets, for example, reducing four lanes to two, could help by simply offering fewer opportunities for collisions. And there'll be more in a sidebar later on. In the Twin Cities Pedestrian Safety Study, she and her team had added signs, markings, and temporary bump outs to crosswalks. By the study's conclusion in October 2021, Minneapolis drivers had stopped for pedestrians 48% of the time and St. Paul drivers 68%. Increases she found encouraging. Turning back to her notepad, Morris drew the path of a careless driver circumventing her safeguards to hit a pedestrian. She said, "If I could snap my fingers and make anything happen, my first wish wouldn't be to do anything with the roads, it would be to do something to the vehicles." Technology that can sense and stop drunk drivers would make a big difference. But, she added, the quickest, easiest thing we could do to reduce traffic deaths of all types is to make it physically impossible to speed. The European Union is moving in that direction. In July 2022, a feature called Intelligent Speed Assistance, that's ISA, became mandatory for all auto models introduced to the EU market. And it will be required in new vehicles sold in Europe beginning in 2024. ISA isn't foolproof. It allows drivers to choose the warnings and speed limitations they'll experience. Automatic deceleration is optional. Still, ISA can influence drivers to be safer. And, as Morris noted, it's highly unlikely that Americans will ever allow the government to prevent them from speeding. Most likely, my driver was going less than 25 miles per hour when he hit me. Otherwise, I would have been more severely injured or killed. Pedestrian fatality rates rise quickly for vehicles traveling over 30 miles per hour. I could find out how fast he was driving. A traffic camera recorded the collision. I could file a request to get a copy of the video. Watching it, I would see how we collided, how my groceries scattered, and whether I held out my right hand as if to stop the vehicle, if that's why the ends of my fingernails were torn off, the back of my hand purple, the nerves around my knuckles deadened. The video would show me hitting the pavement, the SUV passing over me, bystanders turning to help, the driver stepping out of his car. Then, at least from a distance, I could finally meet the man I think about every day because of my shoulder pain, nerve damage, blurred vision, and dizzy spells. But I won't request the video. I have to leave some questions unanswered. I'm grateful not only for my brain's remarkable healing, but also for keeping my lost hours lost to me, for sparing me the full terror of my experience. And there are three sidebars connected to this story. We'll do the two short ones first. USA Today reports that SUVs, pickups, and minivans are more likely than sedans to hit pedestrians because these light truck vehicles, or LTVs, have wide pillars to reinforce the roofs, resulting in blind spots. Second, the hoods are higher off the ground, obstructing the driver's view. And when a light truck hits a pedestrian, not only can its heft cause catastrophic injury, the height of the hood pitches the pedestrian forward, not up, where they are more likely to be run over. And it shows an LTV about 37 to 55 inches off the ground, whereas a sedan is about 30 inches off the ground. And the second short sidebar, in the year 2020, 6,519 pedestrians were killed in the U.S. Speeding drivers were a major cause, while Florida boasts the least number of fatalities caused by lead foots. These states had the most, and there are 10 states listed here. Number 10 is New York, number 9, Texas, number 8, Illinois, number 7, Montana, number 6, New Mexico, number 5, Pennsylvania, number 4, Missouri, number 3, Hawaii, number 2, Colorado, and number 1, South Carolina. This is data, by the way, collected by Forbes Advisor. And finally, this last sidebar, build towns for people, not cars. Most cities and towns are built for cars, not pedestrians. This leads to car versus pedestrian collisions, a battle the ambler almost always loses. According to the National Association of City Transportation Officials and SMATS Traffic.com, that's S-M-A-T-S Traffic.com, all one word, traffic calming measures would reduce such accidents. Some, they suggest. Whether in town or in residential areas, provide sidewalks. Any town that doesn't have sidewalks, anthropologist Margaret Mead once said, doesn't love its children. And while you're at it, plant trees to provide walkers a living fence to protect them from traffic. Replace traffic lights with roundabouts, which slow traffic while keeping it moving. They also reduce traffic accidents by 90% since cars don't have to cross busy intersections. Force drivers to slow down by narrowing the lanes and adding speed bumps, rounded, raised areas of pavement, and chicanes, which are sidewalk extensions that create a zigzag pattern on the road. Make it easier for pedestrians to cross the street with bulb outs or horizontal extensions of the sidewalk and median strips, the small islands that separate opposing lanes of traffic, both of which reduce the time pedestrians need to cross the street. Lower the speed limit in town from 30 miles per hour to 25 miles per hour. A person is 70% more likely to die if they're struck by a vehicle traveling at 30 miles per hour compared to 25 miles per hour. And let's conclude this edition of Reader's Digest with news from the world of medicine collected by Samantha Rideout. Roughly 1 billion of the world's adults live with obstructive sleep apnea. This common disorder contributes to problems ranging from daytime fatigue and irritability to heart disease. The go-to treatment, a continuous positive airway pressure machine, or CPAP machine, controls sleep apnea by delivering pressurized air through a mask while the person sleeps. However, the machine doesn't address the underlying causes, which are often lifestyle-related. Researchers in Spain recruited sleep apnea patients and helped half of them adopt healthier habits to eat and sleep better, exercise more, and smoke and drink less. 6 months later, that group's sleep apnea improved more on average compared to the people who made no lifestyle changes. More than 60% of patients no longer needed a CPAP machine. If you're feeling hungry, even though you just ate, a lack of protein might be the reason. This source of energy should make up 15 to 25% of the calories we take in, but popular processed foods and convenience fare don't tend to contain much. It's especially important to make protein part of your breakfast. In a recent study from the University of Sydney in Australia, participants who got less than the recommended proportion of their energy from protein in their morning meal went on to eat more food throughout the day. When someone has cognitive issues, a doctor might order a PET scan or spinal tap to look for a buildup of a protein called beta-amyloid in the brain, which is one sign of Alzheimer's disease. However, a recent international study published in Neurology confirms that a newer method measuring the amount of beta-amyloid in the blood is almost as accurate. It's also faster, less expensive, and radiation-free. This test is now available in the U.S. and Europe, but it isn't yet covered by most health plans. That might change, so ask your doctor about it if you or a loved one are discussing options. You have been listening to Reader's Digest on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.